Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. Imagine hiking through the Italian Alps and suddenly realizing that the rock face in front of you is covered, absolutely covered, in dinosaur footprints. Not one or two, thousands. And they're 210 million years old. Today on Cool Science Radio, we're joined by Umberto Basilio, staff journalist at Scientific American.
In Umberto's recent Scientific American article titled Triassic Park, he tells the story of an extraordinary discovery in Stelvio National Park, high in the Italian Alps, where literally thousands of dinosaur tracks, some stretching 40 centimeters across, were spotted on near vertical cliff faces by a wildlife photographer. It's already being called one of the richest deposits of Triassic dinosaur tracks ever found in the world. It's the kind of story that makes you feel like a kid again, the kind that reminds you why science is so thrilling. Umberto, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me back. It is so nice to be here with you.
Well, it's nice to have you back, and it's interesting. We'll have to get into this a bit later, but finding out how you as a journalist find your stories, but how did this one first come across your desk?
It was interesting. It was an interesting moment. I was talking with my editor. We were kind of like trying to, you know, bring more stories about paleontology. We cover a lot of stories about paleontology, but we were trying to find something new. And we just received like this very surprising email from the university saying that a photographer made this amazing discovery, and that their researchers were working on it in that exact moment. There were no results, nothing clear yet about what it really meant, but just the thing happening in itself was amazing. So we thought it was going to be a great story to cover, and it was.
Indeed it is. And for our listeners, you really have to look up the Scientific American article that Umberto did to see these photos, because they are astonishing. I mean, in Utah here, we have lots of dinosaur tracks all over, but it's like it was some kind of mass migration of dinosaurs 210 million years ago, right? Because they're all over the place. It says kind of in the information in your article that this wildlife photographer is looking at a vertical wall where these tracks are going across. And so that also tells some kind of story about geology, right? About how there's mm-hmm. some uplifting in that mm-hmm. time too, because obviously dinosaurs can't track across a vertical wall.
Yeah.
There's a thing called gravity. So yes. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that was one of my main questions when I was talking to the author. I was very surprised. I was thinking like, well, did this photographer maybe found a new species that is able to climb up the walls somehow? But no, the answer is simpler than that. It's just these walls were in the ground initially millions and millions of years ago. And then because of the movement of the plaques, they ended up uplifting from the ground. And that is why what used to be the ground where the dinosaurs passed by ended up being like these walls where the photographer ended up like climbing some months ago. That's it. That's the most easy way to explain it.
So the footprints started out flat on flat land, I guess.
Yes.
Right? But then yes. as the earth shifts and things get heaved up, and then this becomes a cliff face, it's still pretty remarkable that these footprints were still there, that they were still intact. I mean, because the shifting of the earth, you would think something would have been lost. And instead,
yes.
it was actually uncovered. I mean, this is just fortuitous good luck.
Yes, exactly.
I'm really kind of curious, how did this photographer, who's, you know, she's not a paleontologist, what was going on where they discovered this and said, wait a minute, those look like dinosaur footprints?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I also, that was one of the first thing I was wondering too. You know, I've been writing stories basically every day for almost 5 years now. And I think this is only the second time something like this has happened. Like, it happened to me a few years ago with some photographers who found a new species of frog in Ecuador, but that's about it. I think the fact that photographers are the protagonists of story gives the narrative a lot of color in the stories. You know, many times scientists get funding to conduct expedition or travel expeditions or travel to sites once they already suspect that something exists or that they might find something there. That obviously doesn't make the discoveries any less interesting, but I don't know. There's something special about the fact that someone was just walking or climbing, looking for something completely different, taking photos or simply, you know, living their life. And suddenly they see something that blows their mind and decide to document it. And that is what happened to Elio, the photographer. He was just doing one of his expeditions in the Italian Alps, and he ended up watching that. Something very important to mention is that Elio had actually worked with Dr. Del Sasso years earlier, taking photos of one of the discoveries that the paleontologists made. And that experience allowed Elio to quickly realize the magnitude and the importance of what he was seeing, right? So he took the photographs and picked up the phone, called Del Sasso, and told him, "Hey, I just found something amazing. I'm sending you the photos right now." Yeah, so that's basically what happened. And yeah, what I'm trying to say, what I was trying to say at the beginning is that having non-scientist characters in science stories is great because, you know, they bring different perspectives to the narrative. They give the story another way of being told, and they are different from the usual version of, you know, we were in the lab, something happened that made us think we should go to a site and we found something there, and then we returned back to the lab to analyze it. This is literally a photographer who have had contact with scientists in the past, and that changed the way he sees life, and he's now able to sort to realize when something like that is in front of him. That's
Okay,
what happened.
that's absolutely pretty cool. By the way, I've never heard of a photographer referred to as a protagonist in a story. That is, that's great. I mean, it was a wonderful way to describe it. And what is the relationship, by the way, with the photographer with Cristiano del Sasso at the Natural History Museum of Milan? How did they get hooked up?
They just told me they worked in the past for another research. I think Elio is a nature photographer, and Del Sasso was conducting some research, and they wanted to have cool visuals about the research they're doing in some site in Italy. And Elio just went, and that's how they started
What
working
was Del
together.
Sasso's initial reaction to seeing these photographs?
Oh yeah, so he basically said, "I couldn't believe it," and it was amazing. He literally said, "I couldn't believe what I was seeing," and that is very interesting. You know, every time I conduct an interview, I'm secretly thinking, "Please, please, God, let this person's feelings come out and give me a good quote," something like that, something that really shows how surprising it is for them. What I mean is that, you know, nothing helps readers connect with stories more than emotions, especially emotions that involve confusion or disbelief, because they create intrigue, right? So that's particularly true in science. If someone who has spent decades studying an extremely specific aspect of science says, "I could not believe what I was seeing," then holy crap, they must have, you know, seen something truly surprising, especially for those of us who have no idea about the topic, which was my case by that moment. Yeah, and I don't know, it was very nice to get that from him. He was truly surprised. I could feel his excitement while he was telling me what the story was, because in that specific moment he already started doing the research about the footprints they found, well, that Elio found, the photographer found. Yeah, and yeah, just want to mention again that, you know, emotional moments are important in science stories because the source and the reader are often separated by a huge barrier, which is the specialized language, the science language, the scientific language. And scientists can talk for 20 minutes about something, and we might still not understand a word if we haven't studied anything remotely similar to what they studied. But when they speak from emotion, it's different. Like, it really hits different. It reminds us that we're both human, and even if we don't speak the same language, the language of science, surprise, intrigue, happiness, fear, and hope are things that we always have in common, and that truly helps the stories. So maybe I'm saying this because if there are like scientists out there listening to this, we journalists will appreciate it a lot if they start talking more from their emotions when they're being interviewed.
I love that. Oh, that's great. Well, Umberto, that's what makes you a great science journalist because you recognize the stories and you recognize storylines and things like that. And it's that's so important about science in general, how we connect just as lay people to science stories. And for so long, there was a disconnect because we didn't have great science journalists interpreting the story for us to capture our imagination and our intrigue and our curiosity. So, I mean, that's why this story kind of jumped out at us. But well, very interesting. And, you know, we've had a recent exposure to this part of the globe with the Milan Cortina Olympics. Some of the events took place in Bormio, which is very near Stelvio National Park, where these dinosaur tracks were found by a photographer, not a paleontologist. Similarly, there is, speaking of stories, the Iceman was discovered some years ago, some decades ago, Ötzi, by, again, not professionals, some hikers in very near to this spot. So what a rich science history this area has. I'm very curious that in both cases, this discovery was made by non-professionals.
I mean, I've been working, as I said at the beginning of the conversation, I've been working on this for 5 years, and this is maybe the second time I hear of something like this. But yeah, it is not really usual, and that's what makes this type of stories very surprising. And yeah, I'm just so glad to have had the opportunity to talk to these researchers. I couldn't speak to the photographer though, and I would love to, but he was, he's a nature photographer. He's always traveling around the world doing his thing.
Yeah. So, in terms of this Christian Del Sasso, the paleontologist, he's with the Natural History Museum of Milan. No doubt they're trying to do some follow-up studies. Can you talk about the further research in as much as you know about it?
Yeah, I haven't speak again with Dr. Dal Sasso since I covered the story, but he's gonna come back to me once the paper gets published, the paper about this specific finding gets published. All these paleontologists, they're doing some amazing work. In the last decade, paleontology has become surprisingly high tech in the last couple of decades. When people imagine the field, they often picture someone with a brush slowly uncovering bones in the desert. That still happens, of course, but today a lot of the real work happens with computers, scanners, and drones, which is what happens in which is happening right now with this specific type of research, right? It is a very difficult area to access in the Alps, so they are using drones in order to capture some photos that only experienced hikers can take, like Elio, for example, but the researchers are not trained for that, so it would be extremely risky for them to do that. So yeah, in cases like this one, where the site is basically hanging off a cliff, the first step is usually drones and photogrammetry, and researchers fly drones around the site and takes hundreds or thousands of high-resolution photos from different angles. Then software stitches those images together to create extremely detailed 3D models of the rock surface and the footprints. That means that scientists can measure the tracks, analyze their depth and orientation, and even simulate how the animals or the dinosaurs were moving without physically touching the site, which is amazing. When Del Sasso was telling me about this, I was like, he completely blew my mind. And there are other technological things that have already transformed paleontology. I remember hearing about CT scanning, which is computerized tomography, which is basically the same technology used in hospitals, but applied to fossils. So scientists can scan a fossil and reconstruct its internal structure in three dimensions without cutting it open, which allows them to see things like bone growth patterns, inner ear structures, or even embryos preserved inside eggs. In many ways, it is like doing a virtual dissection. And there's also a lot of machine learning already being used in paleontology, artificial intelligence. They use it to analyze huge data sets of fossil images, identify patterns in morphology, and even help classify fossils species automatically. That's particularly useful for microfossils, where a single sediment sample might contain thousands of tiny species specimens that would take months for a human to sort manually. Just a lot of things, a lot of things. Digital reconstruction and 3D printing, which allows them to recreate fragile fossils or entire skeletons digitally and share them with researchers around the world. Museums can even print replicas. Multiple teams can study the same specimen simultaneously without risking damage the original specimen. So yeah, just I'm just very surprised about that. And I learned all of this because of this story that I covered. But yeah, it's a huge field, and it's getting developed very, very, very fast.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are in conversation with Umberto Basilio, the staff journalist at Scientific American, whose recent article, Triassic Park, tells the story of an extraordinary discovery in Stelvio National Park, high in the Italian Alps. And I have to say, I am fascinated by this as well. I mean, the technologies that you're describing right now, Umberto, is amazing, and I get it. And what I find really fascinating about the whole story is that fossils, as you mentioned, we could do a lot of research on fossils. Fossils will tell us how something maybe looked, but these are different. These are tracks. And as you said, they're in motion. So this almost tells us, it brings it to life. It's how these dinosaurs actually moved.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm glad you're mentioning this, Scott. It's really interesting to talk about this, especially because I had absolutely no idea about it before reporting this story, but it is true. While bones tell us what dinosaurs look like, footprints tell us about their behavior, which is extremely important. Tracks can give scientists clues about how dinosaurs walked or swam, or what kinds of groups or herds they migrated in, or where they were going, where they fed, and even when certain populations disappeared. The importance of this specific discovery in the Alps is that, according to Dr. Del Sasso, the record of dinosaur tracks in Italy is actually pretty good compared to some other places. There are many localities with tracks from the Cretaceous and the Jurassic periods, but tracks from the Triassic period, especially the late Triassic, which is about 210 million years ago, they are extremely rare worldwide. I think the biggest deposit he was mentioning is in Bolivia. But other than that, they're pretty scarce. So this is basically a gold mine for paleontologists. And this period is crucial because it follows what paleontologists call the evolutionary explosion of dinosaurs, which my understanding is that it's a moment in time where a lot of dinosaurs started evolving. And many of the newly discovered tracks in the Alps seem to belong to this era. And scientists are excited because they could, obtain a lot of information about this darker, less understood moment in dinosaur history. And yeah, I think that's pretty amazing. And I'm pretty sure they're gonna find very interesting things that will give us a lot of information about how dinosaurs evolved and what their behavior was by the time.
I'm glad you brought this up about the Triassic period, again, 210 million years ago, because, in pop culture, we definitely know about Jurassic period, thanks to Jurassic Park, which is why I absolutely love the title of your article, Triassic Park. It's kind of, you've got a job, I think, as a scientific journalist to try to balance, fun pop culture hooks with stories that are pretty serious and without trivializing it, by the way. We want to make sure that, it's a catchy name, it's kind of cool, the Triassic Park. But I just want to know how do you come up with using the name, but yet make sure you're keeping the actual reporting serious?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm glad you asked that. It is always difficult to balance seriousness and, this catchy headlines, because in the end, journalism is an industry, and we want to catch the attention of our audiences, right? But of course, we have to be very careful with what we're doing. And so I don't consider myself the best headline writer, and most of the time, I go for the direct, safe option with a sense of urgency rather than something highly creative. But this story was basically screaming to be headlined with that name. And yes, I think I was just like talking to my editor, and we both thought about it. And it was something like very telepathic, if I can say it in that way, like the Triassic, Jurassic Park. It's very direct. And I also think it matters that Scientific American has a very diverse audience in terms of age and educational background. So using pop culture references can be helpful because they create a sense of familiarity and identity with our readers. Imagine someone who isn't particularly fascinated by dinosaurs, but Jurassic Park is one of those beloved movies from the childhood, and a title like this will obviously grab their attention. And of course, many outlets can, misuse these kinds of hooks to attract readers who end up clicking on stories that are basically clickbait. But Scientific American is a serious publication with hundreds of years of history, and its hallmark has always been solid, rigorous science reporting. So I think the logic should be, if I have a good story with strong science behind it, I can allow myself to play with the headline and make it catchy using pop culture references, because the reader will still be getting something important and real. But when publications rely on those catchy devices because the story itself wouldn't stand on its own, I think that's when we're entering dangerous territory, right? So yeah, I think this was a good combination of good science and a very, spontaneous and lucky combination of words. I don't know. It was very organic, very natural. Yeah, it was very fun.
I love it.
Yeah.
Well, we love Scientific American. As you mentioned, for hundreds of years, Scientific American is the longest running magazine in this country, and I believe the second in the in on the planet. So you're doing something right if you last that long, right? I just have to ask you, I mean, we talked to you maybe about a year ago when you were talking, you had written a story for Scientific American about the AMOC, the Atlantic
Yes.
Meridional Overturning Circulation, which was a big story and something I had never heard of before. It was at the point you reported on it, it was like that current is going to be okay for now. It's stable, but it might not be in the future. But right now it is, because I think it was a little bit of a doomsday story.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, definitely. I'm still in touch with the authors of that study. Nothing really big has came out since. But it is one of those topics where we always have something new, which is completely different results from what we had before. That's why it is so catchy. That's why people love hearing about this AMOC thing. They're always like, are we gonna die tomorrow? Are we gonna die in 100 years? Are we gonna die in 1,000 years? Scientists say tomorrow. Scientists say 100 years. Scientists say never. But we're gonna try to keep I'm gonna try to keep good track over that in order to try to give the readers the best information possible. But nothing very important has happened since we wrote that story, and that was maybe a year ago, I think.
Okay, well, you seem to have a nose for finding these great stories, from the North Atlantic over to the Italian Alps. Our guest has been science journalist Umberto Basilio. He is a staff journalist at Scientific American, and he's been talking to us about these thousands of dinosaur prints discovered in the Italian Alps in Stelvio National Park. And Umberto, what a pleasure it is to speak with you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure to speak to you both. Thank you again for inviting me, and would love to come back whenever you wanted to.